Hello, I'm Claire Armistead. Before we hear this week's podcast, we just wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more information on building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
When I got a taxi to the station this morning, the driver said, "What are you doing today?" I said, "Well, I'm actually presenting a poetry reading at the Festival Hall. There'll be a couple of thousand people there." He said, "Yes, another bloody do for folks with cravats on." I said, "No." I apologise to any cravat wearers in the audience, but I said, "No, that's not what it is. It isn't at all. It's a celebration of language and of excitement and of poetry. And I wish he could come. I wish the taxi driver who brought me could have been here tonight to witness these fantastic readings."
When you're in school, I think the common view of poetry, as soon as you hear it, is like this Shakespearean art form that is for like a generation past. And that's not true.
Like a good time, a straight line in the sky, jump into your blue swimming pool.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. This week we're blowing the stereotypical cobwebs off poetry. In particular, we're asking, who is writing it and for whom?
I am looking for a familiar face. There is some symbol I am striving for.
The poetry year got off to a racing start in the UK this week, with two of the biggest events of the calendar going head-to-head in London. We hear from Solomon O.B., who won the National Poetry Slam, from Sarah Howe, winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize, and we're thrilled to present you with two exclusive yet-to-be-released tracks from the brilliant Emmy the Great. At the Royal Festival Hall, the great and the good of the poetry world, with not a cravat in sight, let me tell you, gathered together for one of the big treats of the year, readings from the 10 poets shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize, presented by poet Ian Macmillan, who we heard at the top of the programme.
Another bloody do for folks with cravats on.
If cravats weren't much in evidence in the T.S. Eliot crowd, they certainly were nowhere to be seen at the night's second event, which was taking place a few miles away at the Royal Albert Hall.
Sometimes it's less about the words you say and more about the intent with which you say them, no?
The grand finale of the National Poetry Slam.
It is not just a word. It is an idea. You cannot kill an idea. Ideas spread like wildfire. It is a way of behaving. It is a way of viewing yourself and others around you. It is less than. It is 3/5 of a man. It is a salary cap. It is a life expectancy. It is only good for spitting bars on tracks. It is a fast track to behind bars. It is I can't. It is not the skin colour. It is a way of viewing yourself and others around you. And it will hold you down far more than James ever could. And whether you spell it N-I-G-G-A or E-R, A and E-R can only ever lead to sickness. Witness my fitness, my roots maneuver all the way deep back into Africa's heart. I'm just trying to embrace it into my veins the same way my foster parents let me into theirs.
That was 24-year-old Solomon O.B., winner of this year's National Poetry Slam. We'll hear more from him later on. But first, back to the T.S. Eliot Award, which, highly unusually for this rather grand prize, was won by a debut collection. It was Loop of Jade by Sarah Howe, who joins us in the studio to discuss it, along with the singer-songwriter Emma Lee Moss, a.k.a. Emmy the Great. Congratulations, Sarah. How did it feel to win this? I mean, it's very rare for a first-time collection to win.
Yeah, it was a little bit overwhelming, actually, because I guess I'd thought in my mind that it's something that you might aim for at the very end of your career, maybe. So it was a wonderful feeling, but also maybe I'll spend the rest of my writing life trying to truly, truly deserve it.
You have had a career. There is a sort of well-kept secretness about poets who are coming up. You do collections and things, and you have won prizes before for them, haven't you?
Well, I suppose maybe a few years back I won an Eric Gregory Award, which is an award for poets under 30 and is very helpful in giving young poets a little bit of a boost, I think. I guess way back as a teenager when I was maybe 16, I won this thing called the Foyle Young Poets, which was actually really influential on the course of my life in some ways, because the prize of that is a week's writing course with established poets. And the lovely thing about that meant that I met some other young poets who fired me up, and some of them are still friends, actually.
I don't know how much the readings influence the judges, because the final judging meeting happens the day after, but you actually did give the stonking performance of the evening, I have to say. And let's just listen into a little bit of that now.
Something sets us looking for a place. For many minutes every day, we lose ourselves to somewhere else. Even without knowing, we are between the enveloping sheets of a childhood bed, or crossing that bright, willow-bounded weir at dusk. Tell me, why have I come? I caught the first coach of the morning outside the Grand Hotel in town, wheeled my case through the silent, still dark streets of the English Quarter, the funereal stonework facades with the air of Whitehall or the cenotaph, but planted on Earth's other side. Here, no sign of life save for street hawkers, solicitous, arranging their slatted crates, stacks of bamboo steamers, battered woks to some familiar inward plan. I watch the sun come up through tinted plexiglass. I try to sleep, but my eyes snag on every flitting tubular tree, their sword-like leaves. Blue metal placards at the roadside, their intricate brooch-like signs in white, that no one disobeys. I am looking for a familiar face. There is some symbol I am striving for. Yesterday, I sat in a cafe while it poured, drops like warm clots colliding with the Perspex gunnel roof, to the humid strains of Frank Sinatra? Unexpectedly strange, I fingered the single glossy orchid. I couldn't decide if it was real. I picked at anemic bamboo shoots, lotus root like the plastic nozzle of a watering can, oversourced, not like you would make at home. I counted out the change in Cantonese, yat yi sam say, like a baby. The numbers are the scraps that stay with me. I hear again your voice, firm at first, then almost querulous, asking me not to go. I try to imagine you as a girl, a street of four-story plastered buildings, carved wooden doors, weathered, almost shrines, like in those postcards of old Hong Kong you loved. You, a child in bed, the neighbours always in and out, a terrier dog, half-finished bowls of rice, the ivory mahjong tablets clacking like joints, swift and mechanical, shrill cries, ay-ya, far late into the night. My heart is bounded in a scallop shell. This strange pilgrimage to home.
Sarah, tell us the story of that particular poem.
It's called Crossing from Guangdong, and it tells a story of one of my first trips back to mainland China, almost a pilgrimage, really, where for the very first time I went to the Chinese province, Guangdong, and the very city where we think my mum was born. And I took a bus and made the same journey, the same crossing over to Hong Kong Island that she made when she was a baby. So she had been abandoned, given up by her natural family, and taken in by a woman who, just as the Communist Revolution was sort of brewing around 1949, took her across the water to the safe haven of Hong Kong Island. And I sort of felt this need, which I didn't quite understand at the time, to reenact that journey. And that poem tells that story.
And you write partly in Chinese. There are little bits of little words keep cropping up in your poetry.
Yeah, though that's complicated, actually, because I, unlike Emma, never grew up speaking or understanding Cantonese. I had baby Cantonese, but I actually, as an adult, made a deliberate effort to learn Mandarin. So I went to SOAS in London to learn Chinese, but it's a different dialect to my mum's. So the book almost charts my progress from feeling slightly ashamed that Chinese is my mother's tongue, but not my mother tongue, and trying to make a connection for myself with that language as a route into my heritage.
I know Emma will have something to say about that. And some listeners at this point might be wondering why we've invited you onto the podcast. And it's for a really special reason, which was that it was Emma who first introduced the Loop of Jade to us at The Guardian back in the summer of 2014. And she wrote, like me, she's half English and half Chinese. I soon discovered that I couldn't read her book in public for fear of crying in front of strangers. The way Loop of Jade found me began to feel like some kind of crazy magic, like the sudden appearance of water, just as you noticed you were thirsty.
Aww.
Say more about that.
Yeah, well, actually, Loop of Jade did change my life.
You didn't know each other. You were born within the same year in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Both of you have English fathers and Chinese mothers. Are you telling me you didn't know each other?
We did. So I can't look at you because I might cry. I've got a shield up against her face. Around the beginning of this year, the strange realization. I looked up and I was like, oh, I'm half Chinese. And I grew up in Hong Kong. And I've been living in the West all this time for most of my adult life and trying so hard to be a part of Western culture. I suddenly grew out of that and I was like, I think I'll look for books that are about people like me. I've never read a book that has a half Chinese protagonist. I've never read a book about Hong Kong. I'll go look for it. And then suddenly out of nowhere, Sarah emailed me and said, we were born in the same year. I lived on this street, by the way, my parents live there now. Would you like to read my poetry? And it's like I had asked the universe for this little thing and it arrived the next day. And it is so extraordinary to see yourself in a book, not literally myself, but to see someone who is similar to yourself in a book. I had no idea.
So what were the poems that you particularly related to?
Crossing from Guangdong, that is the one. Well, it's the second poem in the book, so that really sets me going. Just because as well, I have a Chinese mum too, and I don't feel like I've honoured her. I speak Cantonese, but I don't speak to her always in Cantonese. She'll speak to me and I'll be like speaking back in English because that's just what I do. Just something about it, it just makes me think so much of my mum. And also your mum's story is so harrowing in a way. Because I've been doing this reading thing, whenever I think about people who were coming from communist China at that time your mum was coming, and I think about my mum, although my mum had quite a hard upbringing, her family didn't have money, she had to leave school and work for them, but she had so much freedom. And I feel so lucky that she had such a different experience from so many people in China. And that also makes me very tearful. I'm just going through a bit of a thing at the moment.
We might have to get some handkerchiefs out. We heard Ian McMillan talking at the beginning of this podcast about the popular misconception that poetry is an elitist art. Now, a lot of people do still think that. But there is a spectrum, and you could actually see that spectrum at the T.S. Eliot readings themselves, all the way from Claudia Rankine, which is quite complicated, formally knotty, difficult prose poetry, a lot of it, through to you and to people writing poems about dogs and animals, and Les Murray writing about the problem of dealing with carers as an old person. What is the difference between lyrics and poetry? Because lyrics, one would say, song lyrics are very popular.
I think that song lyrics are good when you have the melody to them. I think if you actually read a lot of your favourite songs, your favourite pop song lyrics out loud, you'll think, oh, that doesn't have the same effect as when I heard it sung. And I think that poetry is less effective with music, and I'm not really sure why. I think because the music fills in so much space and so much conceptual space and literal space.
There's something about refrains, isn't there? I was looking through your lyrics and there's one poem, Never Go Home, which you use the sentence, we can never go home, 19 times, which is nearly half the lines in the whole song. Is that repetition?
So many people as well will say, I don't really listen to pop music for the lyrics. You know, the music is the thing that hits you first. However, I do think that's different in hip hop. And I think when writing my lyrics and bashing against the wall, trying to put more words in and realizing it's not going to work, I always think, well, if I was a rapper, then I could get these ideas in.
You've got a new song called Phoenixes, which does have really... I want to know what the story of Phoenixes is from the lyrics. So can we listen to a little bit of that now?
Oh, sure, yeah. The Phoenixes headed west, cross-country, Nebraska, Nevada. The Phoenix has to leave its nest, but change is good for some. It is not good for others. First there were five, then there were four. Leaf, he changed his colours, that's for sure. River was your favourite, his eyes were aqua. who's in our history now, like Cleopatra. And you, my screen grab beauty queen, typing out your next life dream, like we were 17.
The Phoenixes headed west, cross country, Nebraska, Nevada. The phoenix has to leave its nest, but change is good for some. It is not good for others. First there were five, then there were four. Leafy changes colors, that's for sure. River was your favorite, his eyes were aqua. He's in our history now, like Cleopatra. And you, my screen grab beauty queen, typing something out in green, like we were 17.
Tell us about phoenixes. What's going on in that song?
Well, I would say as well, it's, if I looked at phoenixes next to one of these guys' poetry, I wouldn't feel like calling myself a poet. But when I sing it, it feels like the idea is getting across better. But it's a little bit about the death of magazines. It's about my friendship with my best friend when I was 17, in the era of tearing out pictures of heartthrobs and sticking them on your wall with blue tack. And it's about looking at a picture of River Phoenix. And then this imagined story of what happened to the Phoenix family, how they were in a cult and then they traveled to LA and then one of them becomes very famous and dies tragically. And then how I and my best friend are looking at this on the early days of the internet back in the 90s.
I'm going to bring Solomon in now. Thank you, Solomon. You've been very patient.
No problem.
You're a slammer. Do you write poetry for the page as well as for the stage?
It's funny you should say that, actually. I have a line in one of my poems that's like, my poetry is more for the stage than for the page. The page is just a medium for me to get my ideas out. Yeah, I think they can be equally at home in either place.
On a spectrum between Sarah's poetry and Emma's lyrics, where do you feel your stands?
It's quite hard to say because, no disrespect, I've not heard either of you yet, so I could answer that question accurately. In between poetry and music, I would put myself kind of slap bang in the middle of both. Like, I'd say I'm a musician first and foremost, but all of my music is poetic. I feel like there's no reason for music and poetry to be mutually exclusive. Music can be poetic, poetry can be musical, depending on how you choose to deliver it, and it's all just how you choose to put them together, really.
Is that true of all slammers, or do some slammers think of themselves as poets first and musicians second?
I mean, I guess you'd have to ask them, really, because it's very person to person. I mean, that's the thing I like about the poetry scene in general, is that, like, there isn't one type of slam poem. It's quite a dangerous misconception that, like, you know, a certain type of poetry lends itself to the slam scene better than others. So I take myself, for example, I'm quite a loud, expressive performer. My performance is a massive element of what I do, as well as my words themselves. But you could be a far more kind of laid-back, reserved performer, and your words can still be just as impactful. So there's no reason to kind of shy away from the scene because you don't feel you fit in the box of what slam poetry should be.
Now, Kai Miller, who was one of the judges of the T.S. Eliot Prize, actually started as a slammer and he's always felt slightly embarrassed as having been a slammer. Is this something you've ever played with?
Well, Kai's work, I mean, it was such an honour for him to be on the panel that awarded me this prize because, I mean, all the poets and Kai in particular, thematically, I suppose, has been a huge inspiration to me. I mean, the way that Emma was talking about this sort of lack of mirrors, the absence of people who look like us in Western literature, I was sort of, as a teenager, trying to fill that gap by reading Caribbean writers, and Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea sort of spoke to me a little bit like that in terms of this story of a woman who starts out in the vibrant, bright tropics and ends up in cold, grey England.
Funny enough, I grew up in Africa, although I don't have your mixed background, and it speaks to me as well, Wide Sargasso Sea.
Oh, that's wonderful. I guess that's the power of these things. But Kai's work, and particularly his latest collection, The Cartographer, really helped me to think about some of the ideas about the uncategorisableness of our identities, that people might seek their definition across boundaries. And as a poet, you might be both a slammer and a page poet rather than it being an either-or situation. So I've been really involved in the last few years in a mentoring scheme called The Complete Works, which brings up black and minority ethnic writers and sort of helps them on the way by giving them a mentor and workshops and so on towards their first books. As a part of that group, I suddenly found all these other poets who were dealing with not the same, but really analogous themes and ideas to do with where is home, how do I reconcile myself to and have a relationship with a place where I was born but have not lived for most of my life? How do I code switch between the different people in my life, family and outside? And actually something that I really learnt from some of the brilliant poets I was encountering in those workshops, like Wo Sanshire, Kayo Chingonye, many others, was the power of oral performance. And so I've tried hard to work on that moment of encounter with an audience, I think. I feel like not all of my poems can come across in them, all their meanings in layers, at a single swipe, as it were, at a reading. But you might get something else, you might get an experience more like music. And I think it's telling that the way Emma's work was first introduced to me was that poets love her. So there were these poets who were talking about her work and they said to me, wait a sec, you look really like this person, you should check out her music. So I think even if poetry and lyrics are not exactly the same art forms, poets are certainly immensely inspired by lyricists like Emmy the Great.
You live in a poetry world, don't you, Emmy? Presumably quite unusually for singers.
I have a lot of... My boyfriend does remark that a lot of my friends are poets or writers. I think I started writing songs because I wanted to write little short stories, and maybe I'm a little bit lazy and I wanted to do it in about five lines. I'm not sure. But I always wanted to say Solomon as well. I think like what you do is so creative. And I saw this performance of yours at Bristol University and it's almost like an essay. It's poetry towards the end, you know, but at the beginning I'm like, is this a lecture? Is it is it just like a story? And then it starts coming together and the rhythm comes in. And it was just such an excellent experience.
Do you identify with what Sarah was saying about that search for identity? Mm. What is your background?
Both parents are Nigerian. I was born in Hackney, and definitely something I identify with growing up in a predominantly white area.
So you then moved to Eastbourne, of all places. Now, for anybody who doesn't live in the UK, doesn't know what Eastbourne means, it means old people and peers.
Pretty much, yeah. I think growing up for me, it was only when I kind of moved away to Bath and then to Bristol afterwards that just being around more people of colour and you start to identify with certain parts of your upbringing and parts of your environment in the way that there aren't many people you can relate to on that basis. So a lot of my writings actually started to explore that theme itself.
You're quite political in your poetry.
I wouldn't say so.
It's about race.
I mean, I guess it's the politics of race, but I don't know. I always say I never like to write on something that I would never claim I'm like an expert or know a lot on it. So for me, it's just me dealing with my experience of race or my experience of people's perceptions of it. So they look at me and assume, oh, you're going to be X, Y, and Z because you look a certain way. And a lot of the things you'll find in my writing are just kind of extracts from conversations and experiences that I've had.
You've talked about the poetry scene, and this slam was Hammer and Tongue.
Hammer and Tongue.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so they had their own separate nights in different cities across the UK. I qualified through Hammer and Tongue Bristol. I think the platform they actually give people on a national scale, I think they're the only national slam in the UK. And I think personally that's amazing because kind of going back to what we were saying before about poetry becoming more popular and more accessible to young people, I think giving it a platform that big at somewhere like the Royal Albert Hall only kind of feeds that idea, so yeah.
I'm interested in this idea of poetry and competition because poetry is the most far away from competition art form, really, isn't it?
One of my favourite sayings, which has been attributed to the American poet Ezra Pound, is it really matters that great poems get written and it doesn't matter a damn who writes them. And I guess the reason I find that a moving thought is because it cuts against this idea of competition, that we're all there in the bigger picture and the wider social consciousness, and the ego of the individual poet doesn't matter all that much. I guess you might think that prizes are all about competition, but actually my experience of the last few days and all of the reading and the prize giving of the Eliots was that the poets on that shortlist were remarkably supportive of each other and heard that reading at the festival hall and thought, yeah, this is great. It's great that poetry can do this and that we're all here together. And it was really lovely, actually, that when I won, I was sort of shocked and went into this almost like catatonic shell shock for a while. And the senior poets, like the much older, amazing, famous
like
poets,
Patterson,
people like Don Patterson, Claudia Rankine, Sean O'Brien, Mark Doty, were coming up to me and saying, we've won this before. We're so delighted that a new generation is coming through, and it was the right choice. And I thought that was so generous of them.
And you won by 0.1 points.
It was a close one.
And what did that feel like? I mean, that is really adrenalised competition, isn't it? It's not the same sort of competition, really.
To be honest, when I saw it and it was 0.1,
there was a
feeling of guilt a little bit, because it's like, it was so close, and honestly, anybody in the final could have taken it. It was an incredibly high quality, and the level was crazy.
Who came second? Who is the one who is 0.1 points behind you?
Her name is Sade Joseph. So it's myself, Sade Joseph, Caleb, Oliver Femis, Caroline. Do excuse me, Caroline, I forgot your last name. But it was amazing, actually, that the final was actually four people of colour, which, again, for the scene in general, I think it's good to show, like, the amount of diversity that is happening across spoken word right now. It's really nice to see.
And you're all as young as you. You're 24.
Yeah, I think young as me or younger.
So is this the nursery for baby poets?
When you're in school, I think the common view of poetry, as soon as you hear it, is, like, this Shakespearean art form that is for, like, a generation past. And that's not true. And I think what's happening now with the resurgence of, like, spoken word, I think it shows there is a medium just for young people like myself as anybody else. So
one thought that immediately comes from that is I've listened to you, all of you, on YouTube. And how much has that availability, how much difference has that made to your work?
Well, playing live, I remember when people started filming every single show, and it was a definite change. For me, it gave me more pressure.
Except for Phoenix's, isn't it? I couldn't find that on YouTube.
Oh, no, that's not released yet.
But you have done performances of it. So people are recording performances a lot of the time,
actually,
aren't they?
Well, actually, that's the thing. When you write a new song and you want to play it, and I did that, and then it came to being recorded, and I thought, oh, it's going to be on the album. I don't want people to know it yet. I had to track down all the people who had recorded it, and I had to barter with them to get it off the internet. So, I mean, it's wonderful that people can, your relatives abroad can look at your show the next day and say, oh, you did this, you wore that, that's great. But I find it very angsty sometimes.
In terms of poetry slamming, is that part of why it's growing in popularity? Because it's out there, it's very familiar.
Yeah, I think, like, the fact that I can watch someone from Ireland or United States or wherever see their poetry, find them on their Facebook page or Twitter and engage in a conversation with that person, that's amazing to me.
And as far as your work goes, Sarah?
Actually, I think the YouTube video of mine I'm most proud of isn't the ones of me reading, but is the one which is a film poem of Stephen Hawking reading the poem that I wrote for him on National Poetry Day this year. And that's been a sort of amazing thing to do, because the brief for that commissioned poem was to write something that would touch a lot of people and speak to them. And it's sort of amazing that because of him sharing it on his Facebook page and so on, hundreds of thousands of people have watched that. And people all over the world have been writing comments about how it sort of fell into their life. And they didn't know that they needed a poem, but that it gave them something and they were moved by it. And that is a poem about theoretical physics and the physics of light and black holes, you know? And yet, with that difficult subject matter, very complex subject matter, still, I wanted to say something in the poem about how we fit into the universe. And I think that's maybe the best thing that poetry can do, make us think about these questions and reach out to each other. And YouTube and social media is sort of the way to do that these days.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.
Now, here's the million-dollar question. Who are you reading? Who are the poets, poets and the singers, poets who are up and coming today?
Actually, because I'm living in the States at the moment, I'm based in Boston right now, Asian American poetry has been this amazing revelation to me. I'm ashamed to say that I really didn't know very much about it before, but I've been making this huge effort to discover poets like Brandon Som, who's based out in California, or Jenny Jung, who actually Emma and I are going to be doing a reading with in New York in February for Chinese New Year. And I stumbled across Jenny because of this amazing essay that she wrote in the wake of the Yifeng Chou yellow face scandal, which was happening just as I moved to America. And it was sort of weird, but also spoke deeply to me, the fact that I was arriving in a country just as that was happening. So to give a bit of context, the whole Yifeng Chou yellow face thing was this moment earlier in the year when the annual Best American Poetry anthology was published. And this book gathers all the editors' sort of favourite poems from magazines around the country from the year. And it turned out that one of these poems, which was published under the Chinese name Yifeng Chou, the note in the back revealed that this was the pen name of a white, middle-aged American poet called Michael Derek Hudson, who explained that he had done this because he'd submitted the poem dozens of times under his real name and it had been rejected. And then he changes it to a Chinese-sounding pen name and then it gets snapped up within a few tries. And he takes this as indicative of a world of political correctness gone mad, and many are much more articulate than me. People in America, including Jenny Jung, stepped up and said, wait a sec, guys, this is not our experience of poetry publishing and the world of publishing. You can fetishize and envy our difference, but we face difficulties getting our work out there that Michael Derek Hudson has no idea about.
Emma, you've written a song about this?
I did. I thought about it so much. It's just, I mean, at first I just thought it was very funny. I was giggling away, but obviously the implications are so serious. The idea that the simplicity of the idea that it might be easy for someone who's, Yifeng Chou is a woman as well, he just stole his high school, someone he went to high school with, he took her name. So there's also this side story of this woman who's raising her hand saying, I didn't write this poem. This guy just flicked through the high school yearbook and thought, this woman looks like a minority, I think I'll take her. And so the idea that a minority in America might have an easier life is extraordinary at this time, because people in America are still being shot because of the color of their skin, and they're still on TV doing, you know, accents that they've had to learn even though they have American accents, because those are the only roles that they can get. So I just think that he could have done just a tiny bit of research before he took on this new identity. And I thought of, I mean, Chinese people and names, there's like a whole culture of people choosing new names as they reach new stages in their life. If he had spent more than 1 second, and I imagine he really was looking through a yearbook and thought, ooh, that will do. If he had just spent an hour researching the culture that he was trying to borrow from, he would have had a lot more to say. He would have been able to maybe make some kind of basis for his decision. It's just so arbitrary. So yeah, I wrote a song about it.
Bind your feet with a lullaby. Learn to speak like a concubine. Make them love you. Love you. Long time
A And you're an academic as well, aren't you? So do you teach poetry? Is that your
do
subject?
Teach poetry. I'm sort of on leave at the moment, having this fantastic year of just writing. But the poetry I teach is from the 16th and 17th centuries.
Okay.
So I'm a bit further back.
So you could recommend Crashaw or somebody like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
Emma, what about you?
Well, I love Jenny as well. I went to see her at the Brooklyn Book Fair. And she was reading with a writer called Sarah Gerard, who I also really love. She wrote a book called Binary Star, which is, it's sort of between poetry and fiction. Each sentence is a new line, but it's like a novella. And I think she has a chapbook, but I really like the way she writes. And Sarah and I met through Jack Underwood, who has a collection out on Faber, and it's beautiful.
Solomon.
First of all, I'd say to check out the other three finalists. So you've got Caleb Olowofemi, who's the Roundhouse Slam champion for 2015. Just remember their last name, Caroline Teague. So check her out as well. Sade Joseph. Also want to say a guy called Koji Radical. He was kind of one of the first people I saw that was pushing spoken word in a direction that I hadn't seen. I can't really do it justice by just explaining it. So check him out online. He's, yeah, phenomenal performer.
So, a new generation for a new year. I'm buzzing with it all, and I hope you are too. If you'd like to tell us about other poets we should be looking out for, or indeed share your enthusiasm for any other sort of writing, you can leave written comments on the podcast page. If you've come to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. We've got more exclusives lined up over the next few weeks, including an interview with Pussy Riot about their reading of choice and a trip to Calais to talk to volunteers and refugees there about the literature that is helping to keep them together. Until then, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Tresilian, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.